Welcome to the Lion's Roar Dharma Center podcast from Dona Dargye Temple. This public talk was recorded during a regularly scheduled Sunday morning service.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Susan, and I'm one of Lama Jinpa's students. And this morning, it's my pleasure to welcome, on behalf of Lion's Roar, Reverend Soan Jim Hare, who is the practice leader of Valley Stream Zen Sangha and our guest teacher for this morning. How many of you have been to the Sacramento Dharma Center out on Wiseman? Okay, so that's where Jim's from. That's where Reverend Hare is from. He began studying Zen in the 1970s, and he was lay ordained in 1985. He's one of the founders of the Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group, which I'm sure many of us have been to at various times, in 1992. And after serving as head student for the 2002 spring practice period at Green Gulch in Marin, Jim was authorized to begin leading practice, and that's when he formed the Valley Stream Zen Sangha in 2002. So this isn't Jim's first visit to our temple. He was, we had just this incredible honor of having his ordination ceremony here in 2016, after about a year after we first purchased the building. And he was here to teach last year, and he is here to teach us again this morning. So welcome to all of you, and most especially welcome to Reverend Hare.
Well, I want to start by thanking Susan Farrar and Lama Jinpa for inviting me back to speak here again. One of the other, I can't remember if Susan mentioned this, but one of the other aspects of my biography is that I was on the founding board of the Sacramento Dharma Center, and we looked at this building for a year, thinking we might buy this for the Sacramento Dharma Center, and ultimately decided it wasn't suitable. And isn't it wonderful how things worked out? Oh my God, I couldn't have dreamed of a more perfect outcome, you know? We found a very suitable place, and you all came in and found this to be suitable and have made it your own. And wow. That's so wonderful. I'm so happy. So happy. Yeah. That this came to be like this. So I told Susan, she asked me for a topic, and the topic I came up with was taking refuge in Buddha nature. Our capacity for awakening. So this is a little bit of a, after I made that title, I thought, well, that's a little bit of a unusual thing to say. Because usually, as we just chanted, we take refuge in the triple treasure of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in your tradition, of course, you take refuge in guru, the teacher, the living teacher, Buddha, the historical teacher, Dharma, the teaching, and the Sangha, the community of practitioners. So, when I suggested this topic, I didn't realize that my timing was excellent, because there's a refuge ceremony next week, and some people here are going to take the refuges and precepts. Good timing. I wanted to say that, you know, one of the things that I think has become a wonderful hallmark of North American Buddhism. And it may be true, you know, in the mother countries as well. But One of the hallmarks is, you know, you can help yourself to all the practice you want without taking refuge. Nobody requires you to, you know, come in and sign an article of faith, you know, to come in those doors. I think that's something we should really treasure about this practice. And I have, as an extreme example, I have a friend who did just take the precepts. But after 40 years of practice, and he's someone who did I think maybe 12 or 14 or 16 90-day practice periods at Tassajara. Really? I mean, monastic practice periods. Probably, you know, he was there 10 years at least. And in all that time, he didn't feel, you know, ready. wasn't quite ready. So, you know, this, I think it's a good thing. You're ready when you're ready. And so you can come here, and at some point you may think, you know, I'd really like to express my devotion and my faith, my confidence in this practice. And so then you take the refuge. But yeah, you decide. It's up to you when that time is, and if that needs to be time. Maybe 40 years. So we don't know, but I think that the reason that most people who actually finally, you know, do decide to formally take precepts, take the refuges, is they see the arising of something I will call Buddha nature in themselves. They see some markers of the Buddha's wisdom arising in through their practice in their own body and mind. In your own body and mind, you find some ease. You find some peace. You find some joy arising, and it's different than, say, the joy that would arise in the world. Usually when joy arises in the world, it's because something goes our way. You know, we get something we want. You know, some result happens that we're really happy about, and so we're on board. But that kind of joy, you know, is also counteracted by when we don't get what we want, and the disappointment and, you know, whatever comes up when we don't get what we want. So that's a kind of what we call mundane joy. It's dependent on conditions, but I'm talking about a joy. Maybe a joy that is still technically mundane, but a joy that is not arising from something external happening, but is arising from within your own body and mind. And it also may arise upon some insight into this fundamental teaching we just chanted, the Heart Sutra, you know, this hymn to the perfection of wisdom, that all conditioned things, including the Buddha's teaching, are empty of self-existence. And there's actually joy that can arise upon insight into that, realization, or the verification of that in your own body and mind. So it's a fundamental teaching in Mahayana Buddhism that all sentient beings are inherently endowed with Buddha nature. This is what you could say this is an article of faith, or this is a fundamental teaching. Sometimes to say this is an unshakable teaching. It can't be denied. So all sentient, this is an unshakable teaching that all sentient beings are endowed with an awakened nature. But there's another part to that teaching. And the other part is that because sentient beings are clouded over by delusion and attachment and afflictive emotions, they do not see their Buddha nature. So to take, the path of practice is to understand that we are, it's always good if we can start from the standpoint of acknowledging and confessing that we are deluded sentient beings, and that we are distracted, attached to sense pleasures, and subject to self-clinging and grasping self and others. So it's always good to start from the standpoint of acknowledging that. And then when we sit, when we do our devotional practices, we sit squarely facing who we are. We're not trying to be somebody else. We don't try to do anything, but we acknowledge whatever distractions and wherever our discursive thinking takes us, we say, yes, there it is. There I am. A distracted, samsara is to wander. A distracted being who's wandering in samsara, wandering in discursive thinking and, emotional afflictions. And, to practice is to sit in the midst of being a deluded sentient being and say, and letting all that comes come, and not turning away from it, but just continually facing what arises. But it's also the application in the midst of that of a vow. So that's where this taking refuge and taking precepts practice comes in, because in the midst of confronting our humanity, our distraction, our imperfection, we acknowledge that the Buddha's teaching is that we can and we have the capacity to be free from grasping and clinging to, or you could just say we have the capacity to not believe in all of the afflictive thoughts and emotions that are coming our way. We have the capacity to not believe that there's a self there, that there's a self existence to those things that are coming. And so our kind of vow is, and our aspiration is called, in both my tradition and your tradition, is called bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment, the the aspiration for awakening, sometimes translated, the thought of awakening, the thought of awakening. So we hold some, through our practice, we can see some evidence that we have this capacity. Sometimes I think of this as the si se puede of Buddhism. We can do it. You know, that we have the capacity to awaken in the midst of attachment and delusion. We have this capacity. It's innate within us. So, you know, we kind of have this balancing act that we're doing when we're practicing, when we're engaging in this tradition. Understanding that we are deluded sentient beings and holding as the precious jewel of awakening and holding them equally. I'm going to look at my notes and see where I was going to go next with this talk. Okay, so yeah, so I was going to say that last time I was here, I brought up this quote from the Treasure Store Treatise. It's kind of an obscure text, and it said, and I brought up this line, hidden inside the form mountain is the luminous nature, or the numinous nature of all sentient beings. Hidden inside the form mountain is the numinous nature of all sentient beings. So the form mountain is, you know, this body and mind. That's all the poetic, that's what the poetics are doing there. Just referring to this body and mind, the form mountain. And within this is the hidden. You know, hidden within this, that's a key phrase, hidden within this is the numinous nature of all sentient beings. And this is, you know, that this kind of talk is pretty common and can be, and there are many analogies in Buddha Dharma to this hidden nature of awakening within our deluded bodies and minds. And you know, so you have other analogies like it's like honey hidden inside a hive, or it's like a Buddha image hidden inside a lotus flower, or a Buddha image hidden inside a lump of clay. There are various examples of this throughout the sutras. The teaching of the sutras on this subject is called the term for obscurations, for the things that, you know, that are actually the coverings that cover our nature, are called the avaranas. Avaranas means obstruction or hindrance. And there are two types of avaranas. There are the afflictive or klesha avaranas, maybe some people have heard of the word klesha. And then there are what's called the cognitive avaranas, the coverings of thought. So the afflictive avaranas are things like anger and its cousins like malice and enmity and vengeance and so forth, and things like envy and jealousy. So when those afflictive emotions arise, Buddha nature goes into hiding. It runs away. It's hard. It's almost impossible to see our Buddha nature when we're in the grip of afflictive emotions. And it gets worse. Because the cognitive obstructions are even more insidious in a way. Because according to, for instance, the Yogacara school of Buddhism, which is one of the antecedents or integral with the Mahayana, in the Yogacara school, it says every moment of thought, every moment of our thinking, arises with self-view, self-delusion, self-pride, and self-cherishing. Every moment of thought. So that's, what are we going to do?
I just saw a title of a Zen book. It's called Open Mouth Already Wrong.
Open Mouth Already Wrong. Think the thought already wrong. So I have a story that is maybe presents some hope, some hope, and it's a story about the Zen master Yunmin. A monk came to Yunmin and said, "What does sitting correctly and contemplating true reality really mean? What does sitting correctly and contemplating true reality really mean?" And Yunmin said, this is poetic, "A coin lost in the river is found in the river." So I will comment on this story. And the comment is this, that in our practice, we don't just, sit beside the river of life and observe it. We are practicing in the river of life. We are in the river of consciousness. This is the place that we have to practice. And it's not like, it wouldn't be right to say, okay, now we should start looking for a bright, shiny coin called Buddha nature. That's what we need to do. It wouldn't be quite right to say that. What we have to, you don't have to do anything. But what a person who practices wants to do is, acknowledge, I'm in the river of this life. I'm in the river of this consciousness. And I know that by definition, this consciousness is a deluded consciousness. But nevertheless, this is what I've got to work with. This is my situation. So I'm going to, I need to swim as mindfully and as carefully and as considerately of others. If we can imagine swimming considerately of others, in this life, I need to enter this life in a kind and considerate way, and it may be that It is actually the teaching that if one enters this river that I would suggest that Yunmen is talking about, one necessarily must have entered it, whether one is really down for that or not, you're in it, and it may be that in the depths, you know, in the depths of that river is a bright coin. And maybe that can be spotted. And I think that people who really, you know, have engaged the Buddha way through meditation and devotional practice, there might be some even in this room who would be willing to admit, I think I got a glimpse of that coin there in the depths. But that's the place I had to go. I had to go beneath the surface of my life. I had to go down into the depths. And that's where I saw that bright, luminous nature. And I felt so encouraged. And I felt at that time, I felt great confidence in this teaching when I did that. So I was sitting on my couch one day thinking about this talk, and I thought, well, how do I talk about the fact that we have, on the one hand, we have it's like this. The question is how do deluded sentient beings, how do sentient beings see Buddha nature, given the fact that they, in many respects, seem so remote from Buddha nature? How do we see how do we see Buddha nature when there are so many obstructions, these avaranas? How do we see the Buddha nature through and in the midst of so many obstructions? And so I was sitting on my couch, and an image came to me, and the image was one of these. You mostly see these in like corny greeting cards, and it's like you look at the card and you turn it one way, and there's a person looking at you, and then you turn the card the other way and the person winks. You know what I'm talking?
Yeah.
You know, they're made of some. And so I what is that kind of card? And I looked it up, and it's called lenticular printing. So it's a certain kind of printing technique where they take pictures from different angles, and then they put it on the surfaces and so forth. I thought that's sort of a pretty good analogy, because here's a person on the one hand, a sentient being who is just sitting with eyes open, looking at what is coming up, and that could be called just sitting and contemplating what is there. What is in front of me? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? What's happening right now? And you do that practice, sitting, contemplating what's right in front of you, and then some people report that the card turns and Buddha nature winks back at you. That's Yunmen's sitting, contemplating true reality. So this is a practice that I highly commend to you and think it's worth potentially getting up every day, possibly in the morning, and doing a little sitting meditation. And maybe Lion's Roar lets you take one of these home. I don't know, probably. And you can chant after you do so. You could chant the Heart Sutra or something. And if you repeat that practice, then over some time, and do some retreat work and so forth, then you know, Buddha nature winks. So I have a poem I'll end with, and then we can have some questions or talk. This is by the Zen poet Hanshan. I was lucky enough 2 years ago to actually visit Hanshan's cave in China, where he supposedly lived and wrote poetry as a solitary Zen monk. All you who read my poems, guard your purity of heart. Let your greed be modesty. Let your flattery be honesty. Put an end to evil karma. Trust your true nature. Find your Buddha body today. Do it fast as an order. Thank you. So if anybody wants to ask questions or raise a comment.
Well, it reminded me of a Shabkar saying that you're like a, not you, but I, or like a poor man whose hearth is made of gold looking for sustenance outside of the home.
Who says this?
Shabkar. He's a Dzogchen poet.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Similar to the river analogy. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the ultimate refuge is the Buddha nature?
Well, no. I wouldn't venture that necessarily, because I think the traditional refuges of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are all supported, by Buddha nature. But I don't want to start a new school of Buddha nature. So I'll just stick with the traditional refuges. But I will say that, I will say that the traditional refuges are supported by our practice and appreciation of Buddha nature, our confidence in Buddha nature. I will say that.
So you mentioned vow. What's the relationship between vow and uncovering Buddha nature, knowing Buddha nature? What's the relationship? And maybe what's vow?
The word that came to mind was a Dogen saying, raise an aspiration to escalade the very sky. The relationship is something, and it also goes to si se puede. I can do it, and I want to do it, and I'm motivated to do it, and I really care about doing it, and I'm not doing it for me alone, although I am doing it for me, but I'm doing it for everyone. I'm doing it for everyone I meet. I'm doing it for the Sangha. I'm doing it for people not in the Sangha. So it's a vow is a, a great thing. It has to do with, you know, a direction. You know, the teacher Shohaku Okamura, Zen teacher, says that a vow is a direction toward Buddha. A direction toward Buddha. I think that's a very good definition. And a direction toward awakening. So the relationship is one of intention and one of decision, and one of how we are going to live our life, and what our values are, and sticking to those values, and through many, many difficulties, and you know, this life presents a lot of challenges, and it's easy to fall into a poor me kind of frame of reference, and a vow could potentially lift us out of that and remind us constantly of what our true intention of how we can brought. Somebody says, blah, 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 and broadly benefit the world. I don't remember the blah, 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 but don't disrespect a single being and broadly benefit the world. Or what does it mean to broadly, I think this is it. What does it mean to broadly benefit the world? This is good, actually. Don't disrespect a single being. What does it mean to broadly benefit the world? Disrespect a single being. Those are words, those are bodhisattva words. And those are words that you can carry around in your life and make a difference with. You can make a difference with those words. Don't disrespect a single being. That's how to broadly benefit the world. So I don't know. This is kind of strong intention of vow that I'm talking about, a direction toward Buddha.
Thank you for coming, by the way. I know you're probably busy in your whole other life and you take time out to come here. It's really special for us. I found it kind of interesting what you said, actually pretty fascinating. And maybe I didn't hear it right, but I hope I heard it right. You said something like, hidden within the four mountains, this body, is what I heard you say, is the numinous nature of all sentient beings. So it's not just my Buddha nature. It's like hidden within my body is the numinous nature of sentient beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not something you possess. It's not something that you're not going to actually go down to the bottom of the river and get that coin, you know, and grab it and say it's mine. That wouldn't be right, you know. It's like you leave it there to be appreciated by others. It's for everyone, that coin, you know. It's, you know, and you might tell some other people, you know, if you dive over there, there's a really neat coin that you can see. But just go look at it, you know. Don't try to steal it from everybody else and get it all for you, right? You want to share it with others. This is the bodhisattva way. You let other people have a look at this coin that's there at the bottom of the river, in the depths.
And so is it sort of by extension that if I do my practice and look for my numinous nature, that I'll by extension see other people's numinous nature as well?
It will help a lot. It will help a lot.
Hi. Yes, also thank you for coming again. So I'm grasping, what's the cognitive counterpart to the afflictive emotion? What's that called again?
Well, the cognitive counterpart is called Jnana Avaran or something like that, but it's the cognitive hindrances or obstructions.
Okay.
And the other one is kleshas, which is the afflictive
emotional. Right, and that's kind of almost the entirety, if not the entirety, of our delusional experience is emotion and thought.
Right.
And so I guess I'm still grasping with, you know, this concept of discursive thought, and is all thought discursive thought, or when is it not discursive thought? And is there certainly, I don't know, a negative connotation to discursive thought? And we're in this, we're talking, we're all thinking right now. At what point is this non-delusional? Is it only when we grasp our Buddha nature?
Well, it's clear we're sitting here in the mundane world. You know, we're not in a Buddha land. We're sitting here talking about what things might be like in a Buddha land, in a certain way, free of obstructions. But I think it's helpful to talk like that. And it's this kind of talk is only an encouragement to experience, to have your own experience of wrestling, I guess you could say, wrestling with the fact that discursive thinking is persistent, that that it does, you know, it also, an article of faith is that it does have an end. Discursive thinking does have an end. But, you know, not here today. Probably, you know, because we are in the mundane world. But it's this kind of talk is an encouragement. You have this beautiful, I don't know who did this great Buddha work, but somebody put all the Lojong sayings on a quilt here in the hall. And, oh, it's so gorgeous. And, you know, anyway, number three on the Lojong sayings is something like, you know, devote yourself to the basic awareness or the clear awareness. I'm mis-saying it, but it's something like that. Devote yourself or spend some time contemplating the clear awareness, the awareness that is below thinking, that is underneath thinking, that underlies thinking. And the best place for doing that is in sitting meditation. That's the best place to explore that. You shut up. That helps a lot. And then you sit. And then, you know, sit some more. And then you go to retreats. Then, you know, you'll have some glimpses. You'll have some glimpses, and those glimpses are surprisingly encouraging. And you will come back to being an ordinary, you know, suffering person. But nevertheless, you'll be that ordinary suffering person who may have just a little bit more faith than you did before you engaged practice. And that's made a tremendous difference.
Can I ask a second question?
Sure. Since no other hands are raised, you have the floor.
I'm probably not remembering very clearly what you said. I'm remembering more my response, my interpretation of what you said than what you said. But I think you were talking about holding simultaneously the aspiration toward the Buddha nature with the fact of the present experience of being a deluded being. And that in holding those two things simultaneously in your awareness,
and letting go of those two things at the same time, yeah.
Would that be equanimity?
Well, equanimity is one of the highest, you know, values of this tradition. We just had a Dharma talk at Valley Streams a little while ago, and our guiding teacher was talking about the Buddha's Parinirvana and how in the Parinirvana Sutra, according to what happened at the death of the Buddha, was that he he took himself up through all the jhanas, the states of awakening or samadhi, and like all the four formless form realms of form, the formless realms, and then he brought himself back all the way down through all the three, all the eight or nine, and then he went back up and stopped at equanimity. Equanimity being the place where the Buddha decided to rest, apparently, rest in equanimity. So, however, I don't know that the exact answer to your question, but equanimity, I just will say, appears to be, and in my experience, is one of the great gifts of this practice, the great gifts, you know, feeling, first of all, that you're not. One of the great things about equanimity is you're not better than anybody else and you're not worse than anybody else. You and all other people are just the same. Just the same. And that in itself, if held closely and with some commitment, again, is another one of those great healing, you know, factors of the Buddha way. Not better, not worse than anybody else. Equal to. And really feeling that. Really feeling that. Me and sentient beings, no difference. No difference. Complete harmony with all people in all conditions, classes, races, equal. So tremendous value of our practice and this tradition.
It also kind of sounds like that's almost like the same thing. It's similar to samsara and nirvana being
equal,
simultaneous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's sort of what I was hearing you say earlier.
Well,
whether
I said it or not, I'll go along with it.
This has been a Lion's Roar Dharma Center recording. For more information, visit lionsroardharmacenter.org.